Which New Era Would That Be? By Nadine Gordimer. Jake Alexander, a big, fat, colored man, half Scottish, half African Negro, was shaking a large pan of frying bacon on the gas stove in the back room of his Johannesburg printing shop when he became aware that someone was knocking on the door at the front of the shop. The sizzling fat and the voices of the five men in the back room with him almost blocked sounds from without. And the knocking was of the steady kind that might have been going on for quite a few minutes. He lifted the pan off the flame with one hand and with the other made an impatient silencing gesture, directed at the bacon as well as the voices. Interpreting the movement as one of caution, the men hurriedly picked up the tumblers and cups in which they had been taking their end-of-the-day brandy at their ease and tossed the last of it down. Little yellow Klaus, whose hair was like ginger-colored wire wool, stacked the cups and glasses swiftly and hid them behind the dirty curtain that covered a row of shelves.
"Who's that?" yelled Jake, wiping his greasy hands down his pants.
There was a sharp and playful tattoo, followed by an English voice.
"Me, Alistair, for heaven's sake, Jake!"
The fat man put the pan back on the flame and trampled through the dark shop, past the idle presses to the door and flung it open.
"Mr. Halford," he said.
"Well, good to see you. Come in, man. In the back there, you can't hear a thing."
A young Englishman with gentle eyes, a stern mouth, and flat, colorless hair which grew in an untidy, confused spiral from a double crown, stepped back to allow a young woman to enter ahead of him. Before he could introduce her, she held out her hand to Jake, smiling, and shook his firmly.
"Good evening, Jennifer Tetzel," she said.
"Jennifer, this is Jake Alexander," the young man managed to get in over her shoulder. The two had entered the building from the street through an archway lettered, "New Era Building."
"Which new era would that be?"
the young woman had wondered aloud, brightly, while they were waiting in the dim hallway for the door to be opened. And Alistair Halford had not known whether the reference was to the discovery of deep-level gold mining that had saved Johannesburg from the ephemeral fate of a mining camp in the 90s, or to the optimism after the settlement of labor troubles in the 20s, or to the recovery after the world went off the gold standard in the 30s. Really, one had no idea of the age of these buildings in this rundown end of the town. Now, coming in out of the deserted hallway gloom, which smelled of dust and rotting wood, the smell of waiting, they were met by the live, cold tang of ink and the homely, lazy odor of bacon fat, the smell of acceptance. There was not much light in the deserted workshop. The host blundered to the wall and switched on a bright, naked bulb up in the ceiling. The three stood blinking at one another for a moment. A colored man with the fat of a man of the world upon him, grossly dressed. Not out of poverty, but obviously because he liked it that way. In a rayon sport shirt that gaped and showed two hairy stomach rolls hiding his navel in a lipless grin. The pants of a good suit misbuttoned and held up round the waist by a tie instead of a belt. And a pair of expensive sport shoes worn without socks. A young Englishman in a worn greenish tweed suit with a neo-Edwardian cut to the waistcoat that labeled it a leftover from undergraduate days. A handsome white woman who, as the light fell upon her, was immediately recognizable to Jake Alexander. He had never met her before, but he knew the type well. Had seen it over and over again at meetings of the Congress of Democrats and other organizations where progressive whites met progressive blacks. These were the white women who, Jake knew, persisted in regarding themselves as your equal. That was even worse, he thought, than the Parsons who persisted in regarding you as their equal. The Parsons had had 10 years at school and 7 years at a university and theological school. You had carried sacks of vegetables from the market to white people's cars from the time you were 8 years old until you were apprenticed to a printer, and your first woman, like your mother, had been a servant whom you had visited in a backyard room,
and your first gulp of whiskey, like many of your other pleasures, had been stolen while a white man was not looking. Yet the good parson insisted that your picture of life was exactly the same as his own. You felt as he did. But these women, ah, Christ, these women felt as you did. They were sure of it. They thought they understood the humiliation of the black man walking the streets only by the permission of a pass written out by a white person, and the guilt and swagger of the colored man light-faced enough to slink, fugitive from his own skin, into the preserves, the cinemas, bars, libraries, marked Europeans only. Yes, breathless with stout sensitivity, they insisted on walking the whole teeter-totter of the color line. There was no escaping their understanding. They even insisted on feeling the resentment you must feel at their identifying themselves with your feelings. Here was the black hair of a determined woman. Last year they wore it pulled tightly back into an oddly perched knot. This year it was cropped and curly as a lapdog's. The round, bony brow, unpondered in order to show off the tan. The red mouth, the unrouged cheeks, the big, lively, handsome eyes, dramatically painted, that would look into yours with such intelligent, eager honesty. Eager to mirror what Jake Alexander, a big, fat, colored man interested in women, money, brandy, and boxing, was feeling. Who the hell wants a woman to look at you honestly anyway? What has all this to do with a woman? With what men and women have for each other in their eyes? She was wearing a wide black skirt, a white cotton blouse bearing a good deal of her breasts, and earrings that seemed to have been made by a blacksmith out of bits of scrap iron. On her feet she had sandals whose narrow thongs wound between her toes, and the nails of the toes were painted plum color. By contrast, her hands were neglected-looking, sallow, unmanicured, and on one thin finger there swiveled a huge gold seal ring. She was beautiful, he supposed with disgust. He sat there, fat, greasy, and grinning at the two visitors so lingeringly that his grin looked insolent. Finally he asked, "What brings you this into town, Mr. Halford? Sightseeing with the lady?" The young Englishman gave Jake's arm a squeeze where the short sleeve of the rayon shirt ended. "Just thought I'd look you up, Jake," he said, jolly. "Come on in, come on in," said Jake on a rising note, shambling ahead of them into the company of the back room. "Here, what about a chair for the lady?" He swept a pile of handbills from the seat of a kitchen chair onto the dusty concrete floor, picked up the chair, and plunked it down again in the middle of the group of men who had risen awkwardly, like zoo bears to the hope of a bun, at the visitor's entrance. "You know Maxie Ndubi and Timba?" Jake said, nodding at two of the men who surrounded him. Alistair Halford murmured with polite warmth his recognition of Maxie, a small, dainty-faced African in neat, businessman's dress, then said inquiringly and hesitantly to Timba, "Have we... when?" Timba was a colored man, a mixture of the bloods of black slaves and white masters, blended long ago, in the days when the Cape of Good Hope was a port of refreshment for the Dutch East India Company. He was tall and pale, with a large Adam's apple, enormous black eyes, and the look of a musician in a jazz band. You could picture a trumpet lifted to the ceiling in those long yellow hands, that curved spine hunched forward to shield a low note. "In Durban last year, Mr. Halford, you remember?" he said eagerly. "I'm sure we met, or perhaps I only saw you there." "Oh, at the Congress? Of course I remember you," Halford apologized. "You were in a delegation from the Cape." "Miss..." Jake Alexander waved a hand between the young woman, Maxie, and Timba. "Jennifer. Jennifer Tetzel," she said again clearly, thrusting out her hand. There was a confused moment when both men reached for it at once, and then hesitated, each giving way to the other. Finally, the handshaking was accomplished, and the young woman seated herself confidently on the chair. Jake continued offhand, "Oh, and of course, Billy Boy." Alistair signaled briefly to a black man with sad, bloodshot eyes, who stood awkwardly back a few steps against some rolls of paper. And Kloss and Albert? Kloss and Albert had in their mixed blood some strain of the Bushmen, which gave them a Petrarchian yellowness and toughness, like one of those toads that, prehistoric as the Bushman is, are mythically believed to have survived into modern times, hardly more fantastically than the Bushman himself has survived, by spending centuries shut up in an air bubble in a rock. Like Billy Boy, Kloss and Albert had backed away, and as if a basement against the rolls of paper, the wall, or the window were a greeting in itself, the two little colored men and the big African only stared back at the masculine nods of Alistair and the bright smile of the young woman. "You up from the Cape for anything special now?" Alistair said to Timba as he made a place for himself on a corner of a table that was littered with photographic blocks, bits of type, poster proofs, a bottle of souring milk, a bow tie, a pair of red braces, and a number of empty Coca-Cola bottles. "I've been living in Durban for a year. Just got the chance of a lift to Joburg," said the gangling Timba. Jake had set himself up easily, leaning against the front of the stove and facing Miss Jennifer Tetzel on her chair. He jerked his head towards Timba and said, "Real banana boy." Young white men brought up in the strong Anglo-Saxon tradition of the province of Natal are often referred to, and refer to themselves, as banana boys, even though fewer and fewer of them have any connection with the dwindling number of vast banana estates that once made their owners rich. Jake's broad face, where the bright pink cheeks of a Highland complexion, inherited along with his name from his Scottish father, showed oddly through his coarse beige skin, creased up in appreciation of his own joke. And Timba threw back his head and laughed, his Adam's apple bobbing at the idea of himself as a cricket-playing white public schoolboy. "There's nothing like Cape Town, is there?" said the young woman to him, her head charmingly on one side, as if this conviction were something she and he shared. "Miss Tetzel's up here to look us over. She's from Cape Town," Alistair explained. She turned to Timba with her beauty, her strong provocativeness full on, as it were. "So we're neighbors." Jake rolled one foot comfortably over the other, and a spluttering laugh pursed out the pink inner membrane of his lips. "Where do you live?" she went on to Timba. "Cape Flats," he said. Cape Flats is a desolate, colored slum in the bush outside Cape Town. "Me too," said the girl casually. Timba said politely, "You're kidding," and then looked down uncomfortably at his hands, as if they had been guilty of some clumsy movement. He had not meant to sound so familiar. The words were not the right ones. "I've been there nearly 10 months, she said. "Well, some people have got queer tastes," Jake remarked, laughing to no one in particular, as if she were not there. "How's that?" Timba was asking her shyly, respectfully. She mentioned the name of a social rehabilitation scheme that was in operation in the slum. "I'm assistant director of the thing at the moment. It's connected with the sort of work I do at the university, you see, so they've given me 15 months leave from my usual job." Maxie noticed with amusement the way she used the word job, as if she were a plumber's mate. He and his educated African friends, journalists and school teachers, were careful to talk only of their professions. "Good works," he said, smiling quietly. She planted her feet comfortably before her, wriggling on the hard chair, and said to Timba with mannish frankness, "It's a ghastly place. How in God's name did you survive living there? I don't think I can last out more than another few months, and I've always got my flat in Cape Town to escape to on Sundays, and so on." While Timba smiled, turning his protruding eyes aside slowly, Jake looked straight at her and said, "Then why do you, lady? Why do you?" "Oh, I don't know, 'cause I don't see why anyone else, any one of the people who live there, should have to, I suppose." She laughed before anyone else could at the feebleness, the philanthropic uselessness of what she was saying.
Guilt, what have you?
Maxie shrugged, as if at the mention of some expensive illness he had never been able to afford and whose symptoms he could not imagine. There was a moment of silence. The two colored men and the big black man standing back against the wall watched anxiously, as if some sort of signal might be expected, possibly from Jake Alexander, their boss, the man who, like themselves, was not white, yet who owned his own business and had a car and money and strange friends, sometimes even white people, such as these. The three of them were dressed in the ill-matched cast-off clothing that all humble work people who are not white wear in Johannesburg, and they had not lost the ability of rural people to stare, unembarrassed and unembarrassing. Jink winked at Alistair. It was one of his mannerisms. A bookie's wink. A stage comedian's wink.
"Well, how's it going, boy? How's it going?"
he said. His turn of phrase was barroom bonhomie. With luck, he could get into a bar, too. With a hat to cover his hair and his coat collar well up, and only a bit of greasy pink cheek showing, he had slipped into the bars of the shabbier Johannesburg hotels with Alistair many times and had got away with it. Alistair, on the other hand, had got away with the same sort of thing narrowly several times, too, when he had accompanied Jake to a shebeen in a colored location, where it was illegal for a white man to be, as well as illegal for anyone at all to have a drink. Twice, Alistair had escaped a raid by jumping out of a window. Alistair had been in South Africa only 18 months as correspondent for a newspaper in England, and because he was only 2 or 3 years away from the undergraduate escapades, such incidents seemed to give him a kind of nostalgic pleasure. He found them funny. Jake, for his part, had decided long ago, with the great help of the money he had made, that he would take the whole business of the color bar as humorous. The combination of these two attitudes, stemming from such immeasurably different circumstances, had the effect of making their friendship less self-conscious than is usual between a white man and a colored one.
"They tell me it's going to be a good thing on Saturday night,"
said Alistair in the tone of questioning someone in the know. He was referring to a boxing match between two colored heavyweights, one of whom was a protege of Jake. Jake grinned deprecatingly, like a fond mother.
"Well, Picky's a good boy," he said. "I tell you, it'll be something to see."
He danced about a little on his clumsy toes in pantomime of the way a boxer nimbles himself, and collapsed against the stove, his belly shaking with laughter at his breathlessness.
"Too much smoking, too many brandies, Jake," said Alistair. "With me, it's too many women, boy."
"We were just congratulating Jake," said Maxie in his soft, precise voice, the indulgent tongue-in-cheek tone of the protege who is superior to his patron. For Maxie was one of Jake's boys, too, of a different kind. Though Jake had decided that for him, being on the wrong side of a color bar was ludicrous, he was as indulgent to those who took it seriously and politically, the way Maxie did, as he was to any up-and-coming youngster who, say, showed talent in the ring or wanted to go to America and become a singer. They could all make themselves free of Jake's pocket, and his printing shop, and his room in the lower end of the town, where the building had fallen below the standard of white people, but was far superior to the kind of thing most coloreds and blacks were accustomed to.
"Congratulations on what?" the young white woman asked.
She had a way of looking up around her, questioningly from face to face, that came of long familiarity with being the center of attention at parties.
"Yes, you can shake my hand, boy," said Jake to Alistair. "I didn't see it, but these fellows tell me that my divorce went through. It's in the papers today."
"Is that so? But from what I hear, you won't be a free man long," Alistair said teasingly. Jake giggled and pressed at one gold-filled tooth with a strong fingernail.
"You heard about the little parcel I'm expecting from Zululand?" he asked.
"Zululand?" said Alistair.
"I thought your Lila came from Stellenbosch."
Maxie and Timba laughed.
Lila?
What Lila?
Said Jake with exaggerated innocence.
You're behind the times, said Maxie to Alistair.
You know I like them. Well, sort of round,
said Jake. Don't care for the thin kind in the long run.
But Lila had red hair, Alistair goaded him.
He remembered the incongruously dyed, straightened hair on a fine colored girl whose nostrils dilated in the manner of certain fleshy water plants seeking prey.
Jennifer Tetzel got up and turned the gas off on the stove behind Jake. Jennifer Tetzel got up and turned the gas off on the stove behind Jake.
That bacon'll be like charred string, she said.
Jake did not move, merely looked at her lazily.
This is not the way to talk with a lady around, he grinned, unapologetic.
She smiled at him and sat down, shaking her earrings.
Oh, I'm divorced myself. Are we keeping you people from your supper? Do go ahead and eat. Don't bother about us.
Jake turned around, gave the shrunken rashers a mild shake, and put the pan aside.
Hell no, he said. Anytime, but,
turning to Alistair,
won't you have something to eat?
He looked about, helpless and unconcerned, as if to indicate an absence of plates and a general careless lack of equipment, such as white women would be accustomed to use when they ate.
Alistair said quickly, no, he had promised to take Jennifer to Morhees.
Of course, Jake should have known.
A woman like that would want to be taken to eat at an Indian place in Vredadorp, even though she was white and free to eat at the best hotel in town. He felt suddenly, after all, the old gulf opening between himself and Alistair. What did they see in such women? Bristling, sharp, all-seeing, knowing women who talked like men, who wanted to show all the time that, apart from sex, they were exactly the same as men? He looked at Jennifer in her clothes and thought of the way a white woman could look. One of those big, soft European women with curly yellow hair, with very high-heeled shoes that made them shake softly when they walked, with a strong scent, like hot flowers coming up, it seemed, from their jutting breast under the lace and pink and blue and all the other pretty things they wore. Women with nothing resistant about them except, buried in white, boneless fingers, those red, pointed nails that scratched faintly at your palms.
You should have been alone with me at lunch today, said Maxie to no one in particular.
Or perhaps the soft voice, a vocal tiptoe, was aimed at Alistair, who was familiar with Maxie's work as an organizer of African trade unions. The group in the room gave him their attention. Timba with the little encouraging grunt of one who had already heard the story. But Maxie paused a moment, smiling ruefully at what he was about to tell.
Then he said, "You know George Elson?"
Alistair nodded. The man was a white lawyer who had been arrested twice for his participation in anti-color bar movements.
"Oh, George? I've worked with George often in Cape Town," put in Jennifer.
"Well," continued Maxie, "George Elson and I went out to one of the industrial towns on the East Rand. We were interviewing the bosses, you see, not the men. And at the beginning, it was all right, though once or twice the girls in the offices thought I was George's driver. Your boy can wait outside."
He laughed, showing small, perfect teeth. Everything about him was finely made. His straight-fingered dark hands, the curved African nostrils of his small nose, his little ears, which grew close to the sides of his delicate head. The others were silent, but the young woman laughed too.
"We even got tea in one place," Maxie went on. "One of the girls came in with two cups and a tin mug, but old George took the mug."
Jennifer Tetzel laughed again, knowingly.
"Then, just about lunchtime, we came to this place I wanted to tell you about. Nice chap, the manager. Never blinked an eye at me. Called me mister. And after we talked, he said to George, 'Why not come home with me for lunch?' So, of course, George said, 'Thanks, but I'm with my friend here.' 'Oh, that's okay,' said the chap. 'Bring him along.' Well, we go along to this house and the chap disappears into the kitchen. And then he comes back and we sit in the lounge and have a beer.
and then the servant comes along and says lunch is ready. Just as we're walking into the dining room, the chap takes me by the arm and says, I've had your lunch laid on a table on the step. You'll find it's all perfectly clean and nice, just what we're having ourselves. Fantastic, murmured Alistair. Maxie smiled and shrugged, looking around at them all. It's true. After he'd asked you, and he'd sat having a drink with you? Jennifer said closely, biting in her lower lip, as if this were a problem to be solved psychologically. Of course, said Maxie. Jake was shaking with laughter, like some obscene Silenus. There was no sound out of him, but saliva gleamed on his lips, and his belly, at the level of Jennifer Tetzel's eyes, was convulsed. Timba said soberly, in the tone of one whose goodwill makes it difficult for him to believe in the unease of his situation. I certainly find it worse here than at the Cape. Can't remember, you know, about buses. Keep getting put off European buses. Maxine pointed to Jake's heaving belly. Oh, I'll tell you a better one than that, he said. Something that happened in the office one day. Now the trouble with me is, apparently, I don't talk like a native. This time everyone laughed, except Maxine himself, who with the instinct of a good raconteur, kept a polite, modest, straight-faced. You know that's true, interrupted the young white woman. You have none of the usual softening of the vowels of most Africans, and you haven't got an Afrikaans accent, as some Africans have, even if they get rid of the African thing. Anyway, I'd have to phone a certain firm several times, Maxie went on, and I'd got to know the voice of the girl at the other end, and she'd got to know mine. As a matter of fact, she must have liked the sound of me, because she was getting very friendly. We fooled about a bit, exchanged first names like a couple of kids. Hers was Peggy. And she said, eventually, aren't you ever going to come to the office yourself? Maxie paused a moment, and his tongue flicked at the side of his mouth in a brief, nervous gesture. When he spoke again, his voice was flat, like the voice of a man who is telling a joke and suddenly thinks that perhaps it is not such a good one after all. So I told her I'd be in the next day, about 4. I walked in, sure enough, just as I said I would. She was a pretty girl, blonde, you know, with very tidy hair. I guess she'd just combed it to be ready for me. She looked up and said, Yes? Holding out her hand for the messenger's book or parcel she thought I'd brought. I took her hand and shook it and said, Well, here I am, on time. I'm Maxie. Maxie Indoub. What'd she do? Asked Timba eagerly. The interruption seemed to restore Maxie's confidence in his story. He shrugged gaily. She almost dropped my hand, and then she pumped it like a mad thing, and her neck and ears went so red I thought she'd burn up. Honestly, her ears were absolutely shining. She tried to pretend she'd known all along, but I could see she was terrified someone would come from the inner office and see her shaking hands with a native. So I took pity on her and went away. Didn't even stay for my appointment with her boss. When I went back to keep the postponed appointment the next week, we pretended we'd never met. Timba was slapping his knee. God, I'd have loved to see her face, he said. Jake wiped away a tear from his fat cheek. His eyes were light blue and produced tears easily when he laughed, and said, That'll teach you not to talk, swanky man. Why can't you talk like the rest of us? Oh, I'll watch out on the misses and boss stuff in future, said Maxie. Jennifer Tetzel cut into their laughter with her cool, practical voice. Poor little girl. She probably liked you awfully, Maxie, and was really disappointed. You mustn't be too harsh on her. It's hard to be punished for not being black. The moment was one of astonishment rather than irritation. Even Jake, who had been sure that there could be no possible situation between white and black he could not find amusing, only looked quickly from the young woman to Maxie in a hiatus between anger, which he had given up long ago, and laughter, which suddenly failed him. On his face was admiration more than anything else. Sheer, grudging admiration. This one was the best yet. This one was the coolest ever.
Is it? Said Maxie to Jennifer, pulling in the corners of his mouth and regarding her from under slightly raised eyebrows. Jake watched. Oh, she'd have a hard time with Maxie. Maxie wouldn't give up his suffering-tempered blackness so easily. You hadn't much hope in knowing what Maxie was feeling at any given moment, because Maxie not only never let you know, but made you guess wrong. But this one was the best yet. She looked back at Maxie, opening her eyes very wide, twisting her sandaled foot on the swivel of its ankle, smiling.
Really, I assure you it is.
Maxie bowed to her politely, giving way with a falling gesture of his hand. Alistair had slid from his perch on the crowded table, and now, prodding Jake playfully in the paunch, he said,
"We have to get along."
Jake scratched his ear and said again,
"Sure you won't have something to eat?"
Alistair shook his head.
"We had hoped you'd offer us a drink, but..."
Jake wheezed with laughter, but this time was sincerely concerned.
"Well, to tell you the truth, when we heard the knocking, we just swallowed the last of the bottle off in case it was someone it shouldn't be. I haven't a drop in the place till tomorrow. Sorry, Chappie. Must apologize to you, lady, but we black men have got a drink in secret. If we'd have known it was you two..."
Maxie and Timba had risen. The two wizened colored men, Kloss and Albert, and the somber black Billy Boy shuffled helplessly, hanging about.
Alistair said, "Next time, Jake, next time. We'll give you fair warning and you can lay it on."
Jennifer shook hands with Timba and Maxie and called, "Goodbye, goodbye," to the others, as if they were somehow out of earshot in the small room. From the door, she suddenly said to Maxie, "I feel I must tell you about that other story, your first one, about the lunch."
"I don't believe it. I'm sorry, but I honestly don't. It's too illogical to hold water."
It was the final self-immolation by honest understanding. There was absolutely no limit to which that understanding would not go. Even if she could not believe Maxie, she must keep her determined good faith with him by confessing her disbelief. She would go to the length of calling him a liar to show by frankness how much she respected him, to insinuate perhaps that she was with him, even in the need to invent something about a white man that she, because she herself was white, could not believe. It was her last bid for Maxie. The small, perfectly made man crossed his arms and smiled, watching her out. Maxie had no price. Jake saw his guest out of the shop and switched off the light after he had closed the door behind them. As he walked back through the dark, where his presses smelled metallic and cool, he heard for a few moments the clear voice of the white woman and the low, non-committal English murmur of Alistair, his friend, as they went out through the archway into the street. He blinked a little as he came back to the light and the faces that confronted him in the back room. Kloss had taken the dirty glasses from behind the curtain and was holding them one by one under the tap in the sink. Billy Boy and Albert had come closer out of the shadows and were leaning their elbows on a roll of paper. Timba was sitting on the table, swinging his foot. Maxie had not moved and stood just as he had, with his arms folded. No one spoke. Jake began to whistle softly through the spaces between his front teeth, and he picked up the pan of bacon, looked at the twisted curls of meat, jellied now in cold white fat, and put it down again absently. He stood a moment, heavily regarding them all, but no one responded. His eye encountered the chair that he had cleared for Jennifer Tetzel to sit on. Suddenly kicked it hard so that it went flying onto its side. Then, rubbing his big hands together and bursting into loud whistling to accompany an impromptu series of dance steps, he said, "Now, boys!" And as they stirred, he planked the pan down on the ring and turned the gas up till it roared beneath it.